This podcast is supported by Washington.org. Washington, D.C. offers visitors so much to explore. Just ask Dayo, who shared her experiences from a recent visit.
What was your favorite food all weekend?
The Ethiopian food at Sihei.
And the first place you would visit again?
The bookstore, Little District Books.
What did you appreciate the most?
Really just like the genuine kindness of everyone that I encountered this weekend.
Why should people visit D.C.?
Well, D.C. is a place with such a thriving culture.
Washington, D.C. has something for everybody. Plan your next trip at Washington.org.
Hey, everyone. It's Estelle Herndon, political reporter for The New York Times. When I became a journalist, I made a promise to my readers, like the way that doctors take an oath to their patients. I committed to bringing the truth to light, no matter which party, business, organization, or person I'm reporting on. I have to be persistent. I have to do research, and I have to push back when someone tries to hide or spin the facts. And I know I'm going to write stories that both Democrats and Republicans don't like. But that's what The New York Times has been doing for more than a century. And that's what we're going to keep doing. We believe the public deserves the right to make up their mind based on the facts. So if you want to support this kind of work, you can subscribe to The New York Times at nytimes.com/subscribe.
Welcome to the New York Times Popcast, your green sky and red grass of music, news, and criticism. I am your host, John Caramonica.
I am light as a feather and as stiff as a board. I pay attention to things that most people ignore.
Boy, it's guts season. It's guts season. Are y'all ready? I'm just cutting right to it. Karen Gans is here.
Hey, John.
Lindsay Zolads is here.
Guts.
Brain Trust Activity. New York Times Pop Brain Trust Activity. The three pieces written about Olivia Rodrigo in the last 3 weeks by yours truly and theirs truly. We are all here to talk about the second Olivia Rodrigo album. And at the beginning, we were listening to All American Bitch, which is the first song on the record. And shall we say a tone setter. Karen, look, you've spent time with Olivia Rodrigo. We'll get into the weeds on the songs in the album, but let's just start with the people want. The people need to know. You're in a car with Olivia Rodrigo. What's the driving style like? What's the overall mood and tension and sentiment?
Low tension. She's a person who's good at removing tension. She's extremely friendly. She's very gracious. I don't feel like this is all just media training. She is curious. She asks a lot of questions. The car ride, she was asking.
Defense mechanism. Sorry, just throwing that out there.
She's a curious person. I think she's spongy. I think she mops things up and she has a genuine curiosity about people. The guy who taught us how to make scones, which was a scene that got cut from the story. But
sorry.
He mentioned
apologies to all the baking fans out there.
Let me tell you, we spent a lot of time baking those scones, and that is not in the story. That just shows you what a tough editor I can be on myself. There's no room for the scones. Okay, actually, my editor decided that there was no room for the scones.
I was going to say, I had a little bit. No, I'm not going to let you get away with that. I had some behind-the-scenes visibility into that, into how that scene was handled. And I do want to say, you did not let go of that scene easily.
You didn't let it go easily. It was graph. Let's just say it was an extra graph. That's no longer in the story, but it's fine. This is what happens. Anyway, back to Olivia Rodrigo. This is what matters.
Sorry.
Stay focused here. She's a good driver. She said that she was very nervous driving me, and I feel guilty even saying anything about her driving because she was like, I was like riddled with anxiety driving you.
Can you imagine if she crashed the car? Like, can you imagine if she like got into like a tiny fender bender with the pop music editor of the New York Times?
I mean, that's a good scene, but
We wouldn't, that scene not getting cut. That's insane.
No. She really was starting to panic. We couldn't find a parking spot. And that's actually quite relatable. I too would panic if I had a gigantic SUV I couldn't find a parking spot for.
You don't take on a lot of profiles every year. Let's say it's two a year max. What made you want to tap in on this album for this artist at this moment?
Okay. I try to do one big profile a year. They have, not necessarily intentionally, but they have tended to be women for the past couple of years. And perhaps that's because earlier in my career, I didn't get an opportunity to write about women in this position. She's poised to be one of the biggest songwriters of her generation. I think she's super talented. I think all three of us, and Joe Coscarelli included, had the same experience at the Sour Tour, which was this woman has 10, 11 songs. What is she going to do? And what does she do? She comes out and she's doing like a teen punk rock review. I thought it was amazing. I loved that it was like, oh, she's decided to take this in such a rock direction. And I was like, I think this is an artist that I'm going to relate to. And then when I got the music for this album, well, good Lord, she made an album just for me. AKA everybody else. It's very in my lane. Pop sensibility, super smart songwriting, very emotional, but from a very feminine female perspective and very rock and very 90s rock. Very pop punky, very... I was saying to Joe one day in the office, if Ashley Simpson had been a really good songwriter, maybe this is a direction she could have gotten in. It was a dream of mine.
And also, we want to encourage everybody to go back and listen to the two-parter Ashley Simpson podcasts from 2018 or whatever. You know, definitely canon episode for us. So, you know, feel free to load those up next.
Reminded me a lot of the Charlie XCX album that I love that she did not love, Sucker, that she has since walked away from. And I was like, but that's my favorite Charlie album.
A Sucker
album.
Fan over yes. here. Still goes.
You mentioned the tour. I think you're right. We all agree that we were, I don't want to say thrown off, but none of us knew exactly what to expect or exactly how it was going to play. And even though there are rock gestures on the first album, there was no guarantee that's how she was going to come out and perform and also stake a claim and say, this is the kind of pop performer that I wish to be. That was very striking on stage. And I do think on one of the things that she was working through on the tour that I think she is still working through on this album is what maybe feel like competing impulses, which is on the one hand, big voice, interested in piano ballads, deep emotional reckonings, grand scale of vocalizing. On the other hand, it's bratty, sassy, aggressive, but tuneful rock music that achieves similar emotional ends. When you're talking to her about making the choices that she's making musically, in both of those directions, or perhaps before deciding which direction each one goes in, what was she telling you about the sound that she's chasing after in her head and how she's making the determination, this feeling for this feeling for this sound, so on and so forth?
Well, that she got that deep into that specifically, it was more like she knew that she wanted an outlet for anger and that it was finding voice in this kind of palette. But I think she still is very much a person who sits down almost every day and writes by herself. And that lends itself to that, those more interior, intimate sounding songs. I think those are just two sides of her. She has like mood boards. And, you know, St. Vincent told me, I couldn't get this into the story, but I loved it, that she made her a playlist of artists to listen to just for inspiration when she was stuck thinking about this record. It was like The Slits and Can and a bunch of other stuff. And I was like, what?
How is that
playlist?
Not in the story, Karen?
I ran out of room.
My God.
I know.
Were you saving it for podcast? Wait, maybe you were just saving it for
deep
podcast.
Deep cuts.
Yeah.
But a lot of the things I think also she would bring to the studio, and she and Daniel Nigro, her producer, who was her go-to collaborator, I think that he would try to like goad out of her, like, what is really the mood here? But you know, it's something I wanted to mention. We didn't get into it a ton, and maybe it's too early in the podcast, but I'm just going to go there. A lot of this record is very funny. There's a goofiness and like a humor to it. And I think that's a huge part of who she is too. He was saying that when she brought in Bad Idea, right? And she was like, oh, this guy, whatever. My mind is, and he was like, that's the song right there. And it's like, oh yeah, it's kind of adorable and goofy and relatable.
Let's listen to a little bit of Bad Idea, right? A spiky number off of Guts.
Fuck it, it's fine. Yes, I know that he's my ex, but can't do me what we can.
One of the things I like about the lyrics is they're very talked. The rhythm and pattern of the words, the way the sentence, they feel like how we would be talking to each other. And then they've just been upstreamed into a lyric, a song, so on and so forth. And this is something that I feel like I touch on in the review, which is, I don't feel like there's a lot of overt stylization of the feelings. It's not abstraction. It's not huge metaphor. It's not big picture. She's not giving you a lot of like blank space in between images so you can like ponder like the depth of an image. It's literally just like, I felt a thing. I said a thing. I sang a thing. And nevertheless, I do it in an incredibly like tuneful, tasteful way. Lindsay, tell me a little bit about Olivia Rodrigo as a writer. And what are you getting on this album that maybe is an iteration off of Sour, the first album?
I'm just thinking about that idea of like the talked lyrics and how there is so much more of that, I think, on this record. Like there's times when, is she talking? Is she rapping kind of? Or is she just doing this kind of like sassy girl voice? I think that's a quality that I really like about this record, because we all know she can sing in this more conventional way. And I think she came out the gate with Driver's License, like being the Driver's License girl. It is a given that she can knock a piano ballad out of the park and take it somewhere else and do these pretty stratospheric things with her voice. And I like that she has not really felt the need to continue to prove that over and over again. I think for me, Vampire is maybe still the best song on this record. I think it took me like a while to accept just like how great that song is. Even I liked it when it came out. And then I think even hearing it in the context of this record, I'm kind of blown away by like how many different things it's doing. And that she's, to me, that song is showing like, yes, I can do the piano ballad thing. I can take this escalating, beautiful melodic line like ahead of the chorus, but then also like I can rock. I bring in this like abrasive rhythm in the second part of that song. And I think that song is so successful because it feels like one of the few times where she's encapsulating all of the things that she can do well in a single song. I know we're going to talk about the sort of bangers versus ballads tension on this record, which I don't think is always successful. I think I'm missing that from some of the other ballads on this record that I think blend a little bit too much into each other. But thinking of Vampire as the exception and the one that manages to be a ballad, show her balladry talents, and then also turn into something completely different in the span of 3.5 minutes.
Should we listen to like that midsection of Vampire right now?
Yeah.
Where you're getting the transition? All right, let's listen to Vampire midsection.
You told me you were bad, bad news. You called him crazy. God, I hate the way I called him crazy too. You're so convincing. How do you lie without flinching?
Craft matters in small ways, like how coffee is made or how a wooden table is built piece by piece. And in not so small ways, like how your money is cared for. At UBS, we elevate investing to a craft. We deliver our services with passion, expertise, and meticulous attention to detail. This is what investing means to UBS. Not just work, but a craft. Discover more at ubs.com/craft. The value of investments may fall as well as rise, and you may not get back the amount originally invested.
This is A.O. Scott. I'm a critic at the New York Times. What I do and what the other critics here do is part of the same project that all of the journalists at the New York Times work on every day to give you clarity and perspective and, above all, a deeper understanding of the world. When you subscribe to the New York Times, it's not just here are the headlines, but here's the way everything fits together. If you'd like to subscribe, please go to nytimes.com/subscribe.
One thing that strikes me about Vampire that I think I only fully appreciate now that I've heard the whole album and can see what it was trying to achieve in retrospect. The thing that I just said about like, oh, it's casual, it's talked, it's, I just said this thing and then we sang it. That's not Vampire. Vampire is not that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
We should underscore that. Not only is Vampire not that, but it being the first single, it has to somehow solve the driver's license problem, which is if all you know is driver's license, you gotta somehow connect to this. This is like a dumb problem. It's like a pop star problem. It's a record label problem. It's a person in a suit. No one wears suits anymore. It's an office person problem. do we have a driver's license? No, it's that. So it has to hold that. But so at the same time,
imagine how happy they were when she was like, right. Well, I've got a vampire.
Right. But so it has to hold that, all yeah. of that power, all of that pressure, while also for her not just being a pure retread. It truly has to walk the line between RIYL, like if you like that, you're going to love this. And also, that's not the only thing I do. FYI, just like if I want to like hold on to my like artistry. And so I don't think I fully realized how much tension, like spiritually, Vampire was holding until you feel the freedom on like a lot of the rest of the album. And I wonder, has your perception of Vampire evolved at all in like the 2 months, in the stretch of time since it first came out? Has how you view Vampire, and especially what Vampire says about the rest of the record, has it changed at all? Because I feel like it has for me.
I thought that song was very good when I first heard it. It was like, you know, like you said, John, like, okay, this is a logical answer to that problem of like, what is the first single off the second Olivia Rodrigo album? And it sounded the same and different enough to satisfy that. And I really don't think that I appreciated just how brilliant that song is until hearing it in the context of this record.
When we were talking about just sort of like her dramatic line readings, I mean, that second part of Vampire where she starts to get urgent, where she's like, you know, you said they were crazy. I called them crazy too. There's just like this a rushed delivery and like, you know, an urgency in her voice where you really feel like she is having this horrible moment of realization that she, you know, had turned on these women for no reason. There's another one of these. I don't want to turn us away from Vampire too much, but in Get Him Back, what was the line? But he was so much fun and he had such weird friends.
Yeah.
So she delivers that line in sort of like this like hurried, like, you know, like, I'm just telling you, like, this was such a crazy situation. It's like, it's really not sung or rapped or whatever. It's just like spewed in a very emotional, like as if you were on your phone with someone. You're like, no, but listen to me. He's really crazy, but he was also so much fun. There's so much relatability and so many deliveries that other pop stars miss when they're trying to act. I think it's because she really is a good actress. She's talked about this a bunch. She said that she did a lot less on this album, but that sometimes to get the right performance that her producer would turn a camera on her and that she would turn on the charm because wow. she's so used to being on camera that it helps her just click into place. So I think there's a little less of this on this record, but I think that energy remains.
Wow.
And like, why are these line readings so good? Because she's actually good at this.
I will say the lyrics you were just rapping, whatever, the lyrics you were just verbalizing.
Right. Thank you.
That stretch of that song, and actually quite a bit of Get Him Back, which I think to me is one of the best songs on the record, but quite a bit of this, and I know these are four-letter words I'm about to say, I don't actually mean them this way. They have like the ode to musical theater. And again, like this is a Disney television star, singer, actress. It should not be shocking that a mode that feels comfortable to her is theatrically expressing words in a musical manner. I hear some of this rhythm. And again, I think, was it you said it's like it's not rapping, it's not singing, it's like some other third thing.
Yeah.
We should have a word for that third thing. But that third thing to me is learned how to communicate big feelings on camera by reading lines in a rhythmic and melodic manner. Whatever that is, I don't know what that is.
Dramatizing.
Whatever that is.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
But that's this.
Performing.
Yeah.
It's performance, I think. Something related to this that I love that she's able to do on this record. She's so good at singing in a way that embodies the physicality of cringe and like
yes.
self-loathing that you almost just feel yourself.
Yeah.
And I think Ballad of a Homeschooled Girl, which is one of my favorite songs on the album, is really good with that. But even there's moments on Get Him Back, there's moments on Love is Embarrassing, even just the title of that. Like she just sings with this sense of cringe that is so visceral and feels like something you're feeling in your body as you're listening to the song. Like she doesn't, when she sings about feeling uncomfortable, like there's that line of, you know, I feel like my skin doesn't fit right over my bones or something, which is such a great line. You feel her discomfort in delivering that lyric, which I think is difficult for someone who, as we're saying, like is sort of trained in this actor. And I know there's, as an actor and there's been a lot of like TikToks going around of just like the Disney acting syndrome and like people that can't break out of that really artificial form of acting. I think she is someone who is able to do it in a way that doesn't feel super Disney, even though that's like where she cut her teeth. But yeah, the cringiness, the physicality of the cringe, if you will, is something that is just like one of my favorite performative elements on this record.
Can we briefly segue to something that Karen, you and I were talking about a little bit as you were sort of like in the process of interviewing and writing, which is, again, let's think a little bit about the history of Disney performers and also ones who have tried to break molds. And where we landed on as a touch point for this was Demi Lovato. And I remember interviewing Demi, this is in 09 was the story, or 2010?
I happily pulled up the story. John and I had a great day.
Maybe that's canon too, like Ashley Simpson podcast, Demi Lovato profile. It's a little canon action here. That album and that moment, I remember, was the first time. The reason I wanted to write about Demi at that time was the Disney stars who had preceded were doing very conventional pop, more or less. And they were like, I don't want to do that. Like, I have something else in me. And it was so striking. It was so bizarre. Now we, you know, certainly like post-Miley or whatever, you know, it's like we would never even think twice about something like this. But at that time, it was so striking. But I do feel it helps to set the template for what eventually ends up with Olivia.
Yes. But something else I said, or if I didn't say it to you, I said it to other people while I was trying to figure out the story, was one of the big differences with Olivia, though, is that she's really a singer-songwriter. And all the Disney people who came before her, while they might have had writing credits or contributed in the studio a little bit, the songs didn't originate with them. And like Olivia, it really is. She's like a singer-songwriter in the most pure mode. And that's why I'm still like, I'm a little uncomfortable with the Disney conversation, because to me, it's completely unrelated. And I feel like everyone has had to have a lot of conversation about it, but it's like, it's just the timing of the Britney thing is so wild. In fact, Olivia posted a photo on her Instagram story the other day. It was basically to be like, check out my album at Target. And it was her pointing at a Target billboard, but behind her was the bus wrapped for the Britney Spears musical. And it was literally pulling out of the frame. And I was like, God, this is too symbolic for me that the whole Disney mode is leaving, because that musical is closing. So it's like, it was literally pulling away. And she's like pointing to her album that's for sale. I was like, my God, a new day has dawned. It's just such a different, she's just a different kind of artist. She's a real artist.
How do you locate what Olivia is doing on this album, whether in a Disney lineage or in just a general pop lineage? How do you locate this kind of stylistic push and pull? Because often I think, and again, Miley is the disruptor for this, I think, in a lot of ways. But if you think of an earlier generation of especially female pop stars, find a mode, succeed at the mode, repeat 10x. You could have evolutions. Britney obviously evolved over the years, you know, like someone like, to me, like someone like Katie, never like totally evolved. Where do you see Olivia starting out with basically, I got at least two modes at minimum. I've got two. Like, where does that place her in the lineage of pop stars, but also who does it put her in conversation with? Y'all just making crazy faces.
Because I think it puts her in conversation with Taylor, which is a ticklish topic.
Let's go.
Let's go there.
We had no choice.
Karen, if you
want to go get water during this, Lindsay and I will just talk it out. It's totally fine.
I might hit mute for a little while.
Okay, so it puts her in conversation with Taylor, which I believe to be correct. Elsie, what do you make of that? Karen will just enjoy us talking about this for about 3 to 5 minutes. It's fine.
I don't want
the Jeopardy song plays in my head.
Yeah. I want to go there, but I want to say something else for that I think comes to mind. And I maybe want to complicate the question a little bit, because I think there's a way in which, yes, she has these two modes, but one of the narratives about this record online and, you know, whatever else is like, she did not change up the aesthetic at all. Like,
no,
it's the same color scheme, same, you know, she didn't get a statement haircut to say that this was her second album. Like, it's in a lot of ways, like there's a continuity between Sour and Guts, stylistically, even down to,
Wow.
Which, like, honestly, that was the sort of pop stars that we're comparing her to of previous generations, like to come out with a really anticipated second album, you're talking like complete reinvention of how you look and what you're doing. And the fact that she hasn't done that feels in its own way like a statement in and of itself.
Positive or negative?
I find it to be positive because I think it puts the focus back on the music. And because the music on this record is so strong, there's enough to talk about there that we don't have to talk about her. Like even, I think in a lot of ways there are comparisons to draw between her and Billie Eilish, obviously, but even Billie briefly did the whole Blonde Bombshell thing for the second album, then walked it back to where she was more comfortable. But I'm sure there was pressure on someone like Olivia to, you know, almost like visually and aesthetically telegraph this idea that this is Olivia 2.0. And there are places where the songwriting feels sharper on this album, but there's almost no, like the sound of it, really, most of these songs could have appeared on Sour in some version. And that, again, feels like an aberration right now or a statement in and of itself.
An anti-era, as it were, an anti-era shift. I think it's probably worth saying, at least for me, and I know we've each individually had these conversations, so I wonder where you all stand on this now. For me, this is a slightly lesser record than Sour. And I like it a lot. Obviously, we gave it a critic's pick. Yeah, Karen, thank you, Karen. Yes, this will be my last podcast because Karen has given me a thumbs down. I find it to be a little bit lesser, and it's not because the color palette is the same. I do think you lose a tiny bit of the shock, obviously, because coming off of Driver's License, genuinely had no idea where Olivia Rodrigo was capable of going. And so every new direction or version was, wow, really? That? Oh, wow, cool. Some of that is lost on this. I agree. On average, the songwriting does feel a little bit sharper to me. But the overall affect, there weren't really any moves on this record where I was like, huh, didn't expect that.
I don't think she's trying to throw out tricks. I think I'm
just one middle-aged guy, Doug.
I'm just responding. I haven't talked in a minute.
How do you see this record? Does this feel CG?
It feels leaps and bounds to me, like much deeper songwriting. I really enjoy Sour. The song I enjoy the most is Jealousy, Jealousy. And I find, I mean, even though I am in my 40s, I found I enjoyed and related to the first record. I mean, Kathleen Hanna says in our interview, you know, like I was sitting in my driveway crying to Driver's License, which is great.
But that's how you do a secondary, kids.
Yeah. By the way, Kathleen Hanna, bless, wonderful half hour on the phone. A gift for us all. But I will say that I found the emotional palette of the first record to be a little bit more constrained to like a teen experience. And on this one, you listen to a song like The Grudge about holding on to every little aspect of a disagreement and turning around in your head and just like not being able to get past it. I mean, that I could apply that to like 15 current situations in my life. I am grudgy. You know that. But
big facts.
But I really do feel like the songwriting, you know, she took a poetry class. She said one song was based on it, but she didn't say which. I don't know if she did in another interview. I'm actually really curious. But I don't know. I find a lot of the songwriting to be extremely evolved. I thought of like the rhyme schemes and when she chose not to rhyme to be really clever and interesting. And then my favorite song, which is Love is Embarrassing, we'll get there, is again goofy and cringy. And so it accomplishes like the other side of the coin to me, but it's still more effective than I think she could have been on Sour.
Let's actually just listen to Love is Embarrassing. Great record.
You found a new version of me, and I damn near started World War III. Jesus, what was I even?
I find this one to be a little bit stronger just in kind of the sequencing. Like I thought the first 7 tracks of Sour were brilliant and like no skips. And then I think the back half of that record for me, or the back like third, falls off a bit. And I think it would have been like a 10 out of 10, like long EP, 6 songs or something. But this to me feels more like a record. I feel like I will be more likely to listen to it all the way through in the future than I do Sour, which is still something I listen to a lot, like in bits and pieces. But I think even though some of the ballads like don't really have that pop for me, I think the record's sequenced in such a way that there's always going to be like something else. Like Karen, you were kind of saying, there's some of these songs that are the sort of wrenching piano ballad version of something. And then the light, fun, up-tempo stuff feel like they could be about the same relationship. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really interesting that she's able to take both of those tones and make effective songs out of them. And I think maybe that for me is why I think a lot of the rockers on the record achieve what I'd want the ballads to achieve anyway. So I think some of the ballads feel a little superfluous to me.
I feel like the ballads, especially towards the back end, just maybe if they had come in the first half, they wouldn't have hit quite the same. They would hit a little bit harder, but coming after so many like highs, like spiky highs by song 10, I was kind of like, don't be down. Like, I'm not ready. I don't want to be down here. I kind of need to be up here. All right. We're going to go here. Karen, you have to cover your ears. I'm sorry. And we're going to listen to Lacey. First of all, we're going to listen to Lacey. Yeah, we're going to listen to Lacey. So, Karen, the first time that I heard this record, I texted you. Not the first time. Maybe the second time I heard this record, I texted you. And I said, Lacey about Taylor? And now there is low simmering. I don't even know if you'd call it tension. Let's just call it a cold war between Taylor Swift, a person who has made public embrace of other talented people part of her kind of like raison d'etre, and who has, I think, rather pointedly not publicly embraced Olivia Rodrigo. And that could partially be about some of the songwriting issues or credit things on the first album, could be a sense of existential threat. It's tough to know what. I think when I heard Lacey, I thought could be about Taylor. There is also The Grudge, which also could be about, I mean, nothing could be about Taylor. But the fact that we're here talking about whether something is about Taylor or not, I think is telling about one thing about Olivia Rodrigo, which is that she is someone who points to her influences. She is someone who points at things, sometimes overtly with a extended finger and sometimes maybe quickly, hoping that they're not totally going to be caught. Lindsay, what do you sort of make of the potential Taylor subtext on this record?
I think it's always a losing battle to be like, this is about, so, you know, and if anything, she's learned that reticence from Taylor herself, who will never, won't even say who Dear John is about on the record, but like, we know, we know more or less, but she, you know, is really holding that line, Olivia, of not saying who these songs are about, you know, and I think a lot of songs can be about sort of multiple situations and multiple people.
They're about feelings that were inspired by multiple people. Yeah.
Yes. I think, though, like you said, John, like just the fact that the conversation is happening, there's something about their relationship or lack thereof between Olivia and Taylor is like that it's possible for people on the internet to read into this kind of feels like the whole story to me. And she never really has to say anything else. Like the fact that something happened that could feasibly have inspired songs this vitriolic in some cases, this like sad and just heartbroken and betrayed. I think that's the story to me. And I don't want to speculate if they are or aren't, but if they happen to be and she never says anything, like it's almost more powerful to just let the work stand. And I think the work, the songwriting is strong enough that it tells a story. You can believe whoever you want to believe it's about, or you can apply it to someone in your own life, but it's going to stand on its own. So yeah, it's just the fact that we're having this conversation feels like kind of a win for Olivia. And, you know, I don't want to make it like a her versus her thing, but I'm not the first one to be doing that. So it's happening. It's out there.
She also seems to be doing something. And Karen, I think this goes back to your interview and your time with her, right? Which is on the record, we use the word livid in the headline of the review. Like we toyed with using the word furious. Like these songs are, in essence, if you had to just umbrella it, these songs are like, hey, I got really famous really fast. And you know what? It absolutely sucks. Like, dude, you're trash. my colleagues or like my alleged peers are like dogging me out, not being nice to me. I'm not in touch with my friends.
Fair-weather friends at the club.
Yeah, my fair-weather friends. All the things that I thought I was chasing, I got them and absolutely built on a house of cards. Just like there's almost no moments of like brightness, like emotional brightness on the record. Like almost everything is about, it's not as good as it looks. It's not as good as I thought it was going to be. Karen, you talked to her. This didn't, like, I didn't get that energy. Tell me about that, because to me, that's fascinating.
It really still comes back to the being more of a rock record in so many ways. Like, well, when you guys were talking earlier about it not having like as the stamp of a fresh era, you know, from one Belly album to the next, you know, like they sounded similar to me. But you know what I'm saying? Like, there wasn't an expectation that like whole second or third album was going to sound completely different from the first one. You know, they evolved in ways, but the idiom was the same. They were rock albums. And the idea of evolution is really something that we can trace back to my friend Madonna, if you don't mind me calling her that, because that really sparked the beginning.
Does Madonna mind you call her that? Like, don't worry about us.
Yes, she would mind. Yes.
Okay, I'm just saying, we're fine. We'll let it slide.
Her team would probably mind. But anyway, but the idea of evolving and changing, that started truly with her, where it was like to keep people's attention. She was a shocker, right? She was always going to surprise you with what was coming next. And rock is sometimes more about consistency. Growth and consistency, but it's not like you don't have to come out with a new haircut or whatever to be different. I remember, when Metallica cut their hair, I did notice, obviously, we all did, and it did signal something.
The James Hetfield rockabilly swoop, or whatever that was, like the
Chris Cornell cut was jarring for me. But going back to the idea of it being a rock albums are largely about not happy things. I think generally when people write songs, they aren't necessarily sunny unless you're in love and you're writing like the happiest love song ever. I think we know that she isn't. I mean, I think she's made that clear in the interview. She doesn't talk about her personal life a ton, but she wasn't like, I'm in this happy new relationship. But she also doesn't require a relationship to be happy, which is a truly, I mean, I don't even want to say heteronormative, but like, you know, just a thing that we put on young women that they have to have a boyfriend to be happy. I was watching Coco Gauff win the US Open yesterday, and she was FaceTiming somebody after, and one of the commentators, who was a woman, was like, oh, is she trying to call a boyfriend? And I was like, what a turnoff. What are you saying? And later she revealed that she was trying to FaceTime her brother. But like, somebody had to project onto a romantic relationship onto that moment. It made me so furious. Anyway, Olivia's happy. I think she was extremely happy. I don't think she was pretending to be happy. Everything I gleaned from her was upbeatness, a durability, a buoyancy. Something that I was really struck by was like, if she mispronounced something or got something wrong or forgot a word, she wasn't embarrassed. She'd just be like, oh yeah, right. And she would just kind of move on. I'd be like, Jesus, I would have been mortified when I was her age if I like whatever. She really has that sort of like child performer mentality where it's like she takes the note, she internalizes it, and she just keeps going. I think, and she said numerous times that when she wrote the first album, she was in like a pit of absolute despair. She was a puddle of tears. And that when she wrote this record, she was completely somewhere different. Now, I think she was riddled with anxiety. She made a lot of reference to being like super stressed out about the pressure of the record and being like, and like crying in the studio. And she did The Artist's Way and she tried journaling and stuff like that. She was trying different things, but I really never got the projection from like, this is an unhappy person, a person with a dark outlook. But I think she finds in rock a theatricality that is more fun to play with than the palette of pop.
There's moments of joy in the record. And sometimes it's even in her delivery and the fun that she's having with like Bad Idea, right? I think there's moments of joy. There's moments of joy in Get Him Back. Like, something I like about both of those songs too is she's taking ownership over her quote unquote mistakes. You know, yes, some of these songs are about other people doing her wrong and really doing things that she herself wouldn't do, but she takes a responsibility for her actions in a way that I think a lot of other songwriters her age don't have that level of self-reflection. And I think that's something that, you know, on Bad Idea, right? That's something I really appreciate, that she, you get the sense that this is, again, like a cringy situation. She knows everyone thinks it's bad, but she's going to let herself have some fun with it. She's probably not going to regret it at the end of the day. Like, she wrote a great song out of it.
Having a bad situation implicating the other person in the situation and then sort of writing something about the other person, but also implicating yourself and also writing yourself into like the villain arc. And then adding on top of it, I'm doing it all. And I think you're right about the vocal tone, writing something about the other person, but also implicating yourself and also writing yourself into the villain arc. And then adding on top of it, I'm doing it all. And I think you're right about the vocal tone in a way that connotes, I'm over it. I triumphed.
I think that's another reason love is embarrassing, too, that she, like, when she calls that guy a second string loser, like, the conflict is more in her head than with the other person. And I think that's true of, like, most of the songs on this record, actually, like, you know, talking about the grudge and that she's like, you know, she's almost singing to someone that she knows isn't listening. And in the end, that means she's singing to herself.
Oh, they're listening. I promise they're listening.
I would say the exception and the song that we haven't really talked about yet, because it is like sober, but it's an absolutely breathtaking vocal performance, is Logical, which seems mm-hmm. like it's about the same experience of vampire, about being taken advantage of, being mm-hmm. taken advantage of by somebody older and wiser who is belittling her sexually, emotionally, whatever, just making her feel small. You know, it's not my favorite song to listen to, but in writing the story, you know, and rereading the lyrics and listening to the vocal take and stuff, it's really raw.
Let's listen to a little bit of Logical.
Oh, and now you got me thinking 2 + 2 = 5, and I'm the love of your life, cause if rain don't pour and sun don't shine, and changing you is possible. I guess love is never logical. Sky is green, grass is red.
This podcast is supported by the Freedom From Religion Foundation.
I'm Ron Reagan, an unabashed atheist, and I'm alarmed by the intrusions of religion into our secular government. That's why I'm asking you to join the Freedom From Religion Foundation, the nation's largest and most effective organization of atheists and agnostics, working to keep state and church separate. Phone 1-800-335-4021, 1-800-335-4021, or visit the Freedom From Religion Foundation at ffrf.org. Ron Reagan, lifelong atheist, not afraid of burning in hell.
It's like maybe not the easiest listen. And again, it's coming in the back half of the album. There's something, I feel like it got a little gummy here at the transition, especially like after, was it Making the Bed is what comes right mm-hmm, before mm-hmm. it. There's something like, it felt like I was like, oh, I'm being told the red sign is out and the lights are flashing. It's like, you're going to sit here for 3 minutes and like you got to sit with this unhappiness before I like let you go, because like Getting Back is right after this. That feels very pointed to basically be like, I'm gonna make you sit still for these 3 minutes and really, really get in the weeds on the dark stuff before bringing you back. So what we've learned about Olivia on this album: number one, like modal flexibility, rock, ballad, rock in different kinds of rock, new wave, pop punk, dreamy stuff, a song that sounds like it came off Folklore, etc. Different modes of rock, also heavy piano balladry, also an additional layer of very, very, very flexible vocal tone. And it's like you multiply each of these different options together, and I feel like you end up with like dozens, if not hundreds, of potential outcomes. When you think about Olivia moving forward, like, is album 3 going to be in this same mode, or are we getting a statement haircut? We getting a purple dye? Like, what are we getting? Because, Karen, I think your point about how certain rock bands have navigated their careers is correct, but it is correct for rock bands. And ultimately, Olivia Rodrigo is one of, even if she made a rock album or a rock-heavy album, she's one of the 10 biggest pop stars working in America, probably 5 biggest pop stars working in America. That I don't know if that holds. And I sort of mentioned in the review, it's like, well, she hasn't done a Max Martin or a whatever, you know, whoever the new Max Martin might be, you know, like a Diplo or a Mark Ronson or whatever. She hasn't done like a super, super streamlined, smoothed out, gleamy, shiny record. At some point, is that the own, not, is that the dominant direction that's available to her in order to maintain this level of renown?
I don't think think so. I mean, but my curiosity about I have no answers, but my curiosity about what the next album will sound like was the same as, like, I had such intense curiosity about what the second Billie Eilish album was going to sound like. Because I was like, this is a person who's, like, really grabbing from a lot of different things, particularly, like, you know, I remember it was just like, oh my God, she's the first pop star who truly understands how to bring the ideas of rap into pop this way. And also, though, but it was very dark. I mean, that's another thing about that first record with all the, like, spider imagery and stuff. And I remember, like, going to the show at Radio City, which is also where we saw Olivia, and being like, this is weird. Little girls are really, really amped about this, like, thing that I would expect, you know, like, guys wearing Tool t-shirts in my high school to have been into. It was just so strange the way she flipped it. But you know what I mean? It was really creepy as hell.
Little girls are weird, too. I think they're tapping into that. Both of these artists in some ways are tapping into that.
They are, and it's amazing.
That darkness and that weirdness, yeah.
Totally, totally. I mean, being a little girl is really hard, and it's never, you know, like, it's you have the princess narrative part of it, but there's also the super dark goth narrative part of it, and here it is. But anyway, I didn't know what to expect the second Billie album to sound like, and honestly, like, now it's discussing it, I don't even know if I can tell you if it had a coherency where I would say it sounded all like X. There were songs on it I liked. When I go back to it now, I like it more than it did when it came out. This is a real tributary. I'm taking us away from the point. But I think those are artists where I'm like, I can't even imagine what their next album is going to sound like. And that's what's so exciting. I think that Olivia would go in an artier, Torier, Fiona-ier direction before she went in a Max Martin-ier direction. I think that the artists that she truly admires and takes influence are like real artists. And I am not taking anything away from my beloved pop stars. You know, nobody loves them more than I do. But they are, you know, making music in a very specific commercial mode. And I don't know that that's really on Olivia's mind.
I want to throw another name out there too, because I know I drew this connection in the amplifier, but there's parts of the trajectory that remind me of the second Lorde album, Melodrama, and how that felt both like a sharpening of the perspective of her first album, you know, after this runaway hit. Talk about people that should be getting songwriting credits on everyone else's songs too, if we're going to do that. Everybody copied Lorde after that. You know, and she, like, I hope that the third Olivia album is not her solar power, but I don't think it's going to be. Some good songs on that. But like, this feels...
We came today to drag solar power.
That's right. No, we had a whole podcast of that. That's also canon in the archives. But that to me feels like there's a melodrama quality to this record. And it came out, both of the artists were 20 when they released these, you know, very anticipated sophomore records. But that also brings me to a question of, like, if we think this is going to do the numbers that Sour did, and is it going to be sort of a come down for her commercially? Like, I think Vampire was number one for a week, has been like a solid top 10 hit for, you know, most of the time since it's been out. Bad Idea, Right, didn't hit quite as hard.
I'll tell you that
I mean, that's the moment that she's releasing this into too, of this, you know, rise of the various type reactionary country dudes and the various nefarious forces, like, getting them to the top of the charts. But I'm, you know, I don't care how this does commercially. Like, I wish her well. I want it to do well because I think it's a really good record, but I don't know that it's going to hit in the same way that Sour does. And that was part of the narrative coming off of the second Lorde album, you know, was that it's this sort of beloved, critical darling, cult beloved record, but it didn't, you know, it was not the blockbuster that had Royals on it. So what, you know?
Yeah, here's my thought on that, which is that Lorde made less commercial music that was received less well commercially. And no matter how much people like us were like, this is a really good record, on a fundamental level, she was already making decisions on the second album that were moving her away and moving her more towards, like, grand scale artiste, mass cult, whatever.
Olivia's doing that?
No, because the sonic palette, as we've been saying all along, sonic palette is very similar. And I think Guts is solving for a similar problem that that Sauer was solving for. And I don't know that the cultural moment is necessarily that radically different. I mean, obviously, you have these sort of specific micro blips that are happening that are gumming up the way the tops of the charts work. Like, but I do think fundamentally, a type of person who was here for Sauer is also here for Guts. I'm not too worried about that. What I do think is that it might be a slightly, to my taste, it's a slightly less effective record. And if it doesn't hit quite as hard, I actually want to go in the opposite direction of y'all, which is say, I would not be surprised if album 3 is something that is much shinier and much more polished and much more like, hey, Dan, like, thank you so much for all your hard work on albums 1 and 2. And we would love to have you for certain parts of album 3. But for the like we're gunning for the top again, we called in the big guns.
Antonoff, is that what you're saying?
You said it.
No.
You didn't say it. No, you know, okay. Like I would not be surprised if that is part of the calculus next time. We don't know, but I think that the Olivia Rodrigo proposition, which is to say the fullness of her success, we haven't seen the outer bounds of it yet. It's still growing, I think. I think there's still room to deepen it, to accelerate it. One thing I was struck by, Karen, in reading your profile and reading other things that have been written about her in the last like 6 months is like, we don't know loads. We're still learning about Olivia Wright. Like her public persona is not yet caught up to her musical persona. There's still like a lot of room for growth, frankly, in both of those things. And I wouldn't be surprised if a year, two, three from now, where she lands is I want to be as big as possible. Like I've gotten as far as this particular idea, value proposition, collaborator, etc. I've gotten as far as that can get me. And I wonder if I kind of tweak it up a little bit, you know, maybe do more press, be more public, more red carpet, who knows what. Is there another layer to the sky that I can reach? I wouldn't be surprised if it goes that direction.
All right.
Throwing it out there. You know, in 3 years, we're going to return to this episode, like, where we each have our predictions.
I think this record, though, has bought her a little more time to not have to answer that question yet. Like, I think this record being good and hitting in some way and having songs that are resonating with people, like, it buys her more time to not have to solve that next problem.
I agree. And she gets to go on, I presume it has not been announced, but I would be super surprised if it was not an arena tour.
Yeah,
where she gets to explore all this stuff. And that was actually where the Billy album really came to life for me. Lindsay and I went to that one together, but I could not believe how imaginative and how effective those songs that I just truly didn't care for on record came to life live. A combination of her, the way she interpreted them and the crowd really lifting them. It was very interesting.
Well, it's been a rowdy one. It's been a gutsy one. Karen Gans, Lindsay Zolads, Rodrigologists of the New York Times. We appreciate and are grateful for the conversation. Listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. Podcast Deluxe is on YouTube or at tinyurl.com/podcastdeluxe. Join the Facebook, join the Discord, tinyurl.com/podcastfacebook or podcast Discord. Ask questions for future mailbag episodes. Let us know what you think about Guts versus Sauer. Also email us podcast@nytimes.com. Subscribe to podcast anywhere you get your audio content. That is Spotify, that is Apple Podcasts, that is YouTube, etc., etc. Our producer, as always, is Pedro Rosado from Headstubber Media. Karen, bring us home.
Everybody, let's go out on Ballad of a Homeschool Girl, one of my favorite songs on the record, because it gave me a line that I've been saying for the past month, but nobody knew what it was from, because I was the only person with the record, which is, I made it weird, I made it worse. Joe.
Myrtle Beach is the beach. 60 miles of bright sand, water, and a wealth of wonderful music playing day and night. You can step into a simple beach bar and discover a surprising level of exciting musical talent. A place to kick back and groove to the enticing soundtrack of the most unexpected vacations around. With nothing but good vibes floating through the warm ocean air. Plan your own music-filled trip to America's Jukebox at visitmyrtlebeach.com.